May it please the court. I'd like to focus today on a major gap in the trial evidence that requires Rule 50 judgment for the board. We laid out in the briefs many alternative bases for Rule 50 judgment, supported with detailed factual legal citations.
But Mr. Moriarty, yes. I have to register a complaint here about your brief because you certainly wrote a long brief, but the lens through which we view anything like a Rule 50 judgment, summary judgments, lots of other things, is taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the opponent of that motion. Are you nonetheless entitled to judgment as a matter of law?
Mm-hmm.
And there were lots and lots of omissions of evidence that could reasonably be seen as favorable to your opponent that one didn't learn about until one either delved into the record or at least looked at your opponent's brief. And, I'm left with the sense that there was, a lengthy trial here. We're reviewing a jury's verdict, which involves jury decisions about credibility and other points, and I just wish that you had more scrupulously followed this perspective that we're required to take.
Well, I certainly apologize, Your Honor, if there's anything in the record that is outcome determinative or that makes a difference to the Rule 50 analysis that was left out of our statement of facts. I attempted to do that. I'm not aware of anything.
Let me give you one example
that
bothered me. A lot of Mr. Albertson's focus was on this question whether he was allowed to teach those summer workshops and whether he needed to show that he was truly qualified to
mm-hmm.
do it. Reading your brief, one had the impression that this was kind of a first-time event and was this man actually qualified to teach wilderness medicine or whatever the other things were. In fact, it turns out that he'd been teaching it for 3 years in a row, the exact same things, and it was only in this year that the problems arose. Perhaps it's just me, but those seem like two different scenarios to me.
All right. I apologize. I can't locate
my
brief, and it's possible that I did not note that. Let's assume that I did not note the prior teaching of the workshops. Certainly, Dr. Albrechtson taught the workshops under prior chairs before Brenda Clayton became chair, The critical fact is here, Brenda Clayton, first time chair, being asked to look at approving these workshops.
Well, critical to you, but the question is, could a reasonable jury have thought that maybe that wasn't what was really going on? Maybe it was some form of retaliation, because this jury, of course, rejects his basic gender discrimination claims,
okay,
but it accepts his retaliation claims.
Then taking those prior teachings of the workshop into account, could a reasonable jury have looked at this and said, why did Brenda Clayton raise questions about the workshops? Then adding that fact in, we still have, did Brenda Clayton know that he had complained about sex discrimination? No. Testimony was unrefuted that she didn't even know he had complained about sex discrimination.
Of course, it wasn't a personal lawsuit against her. This was this is the Title VII part of this case, where
correct,
it's the Board of Regents who is the employer.
But he was pointing to her and Greenhill and Barnett as the alleged retaliators.
Right, a number of people. So what was information known to those who were responsible, I think, is sort of more the
that's
way of putting
and
it.
In fact, she didn't make either of the ultimate decisions. The decision regarding the workshops, suspending the workshops, was made by Chancellor Greenhill. So the question arises there as far as retaliation and causation. Did she was Greenhill somehow an unwitting dupe for Clayton, even if you were to assume that she had some retaliatory motive? But she and Greenhill and Barnett all had good reasons for why they were questioning the teaching of the workshops. The fact that they may have been taught in the past and slipped through without being analyzed carefully is something that should be taken into account, and I again apologize if it's not pointed out in the brief. But the critical fact is Clayton, as chair, first-time chair, gets this information and says, something's wrong here. These seem to be medically related courses. We have a non-medical mission in this university campus. I know that. I'm concerned about safety and liability issues. I'm concerned about students being confused. I can't just approve it without getting those questions asked. That was
I'm
all.
I'm sure that's what you argued to the jury. That I have
no
doubt of. Well, okay.
I'm sorry, but that was the evidence that Brenda Clayton testified to that she was concerned about those issues.
And the jury was required as a matter of law to believe what she said.
No, but to justify a verdict for retaliation, there must be sufficient evidence underlying that verdict. And that's where the problem arises. If we assume we have protected conduct, okay, in January 1997, and if we assume we have a materially adverse action, and there's issues on both of those in the briefs, but let's just say we've got both of those, protected conduct and materially adverse action. The problem is there's not a connection between those two. There may be other problems out there, and there certainly were with this campus, and there were with Dr. Albrechtsen. As the record shows, there were a lot of issues going on. But is there any tie between the protected conduct and the suspension of the workshops? First, the alleged retaliators had no knowledge that he had complained about sex discrimination. Second, there were legitimate...
Is that the January 10th, 1997 letter, is that what's supposed to be the complaint of sex discrimination, or are there other... material.
Based on the trial court ruling, and in fact, a motion in limine, which Dr. Albrechtsen prevailed on, he was able to point to the January 1997 letter as evidence of protected conduct.
Is there other stuff?
That's what the trial court said he could do. He could look at.
Yes, I know, but is that his only evidence of retaliation?
It is the only evidence
and the
I
only evidence
having anywhere in the record.
Pardon?
It is the only evidence
the
of
only
which I'm aware of in the record. The only actual complaints of sex discrimination which are in the record itself, not necessarily the trial record, but the record itself, are his 1989 complaints to the prior chancellor. They did definitely complain or mention discrimination against males. But as I read the January 10, 1987 letter, I have difficulty seeing any complaints about gender
discrimination. I
understand
that, but so those 1989 letters that you said part of the record but not the trial record?
There was reference to them in the testimony.
What about these
letters? They were not admitted as exhibits at the trial because of the motion in limine.
Okay, what about these letters referred to in your opponent's brief? On pages 7 and 8 of complaints about continued retaliation and discrimination written November 24, 1997, November 26, 1997, 2 on December 10, 1997, and so on. There's a big list of them.
Right. On page 7 and 8, as you'll note, the reference is to ID. Those are not... Those are not letters that are in the trial record that were presented to the jury. The ID goes way back, as far as I can tell, to App 66, which refers back to, if I recall, the EEOC charge.
Well, the EEOC charge, he couldn't have been talking about a 1997 or 98 letter in the 1989.
The EEOC charge was filed in March, in May of 1998, and I think the reference back there to App 66 is to his May 1998 EEOC charge, which wasn't in the record either, in the trial record. It's certainly in the... We have two records here. We have a record that was developed on summary judgment, and then we have the trial record. Throughout the... Dr. Albrechtsen's brief, we have references to matters outside the trial record without any indication that they are outside the trial record. We tried to make that clear in the reply.
He has the EEOC charge. It's complaining about these retaliatory actions. The jury has in front of it evidence of retaliation. and of protected activity, of complaints. You know, whether he's testifying, I complained, or whether he's looking at the letters. Is it your view that the jury has to have the EEOC charge in front of it?
No. It's my view that the jury has to have evidence of protected conduct, materially adverse actions, and... What?
Does it have to be documentary evidence, or is testimonial evidence of protected conduct good
enough?
It has
to be sufficient evidence.
Well,
whatever, and it could be...
Answer my question, though. Is it testimonial or documentary?
Could be either or a combination of both, as long as it is sufficient. And so certainly it could be oral, but there's not evidence. The protected conduct that the trial was conducted on over our objections was, look at the January 10, 1997 letter.
But I don't think that's what Judge Shabazz said. Didn't he say that, yes, I let that letter in, but it wasn't the be-all and end-all of the testimony? It was, you know, one little thing in an otherwise extensive trial.
That was Dr. Albrechtsen's view, certainly, and the way he presented it.
I thought Judge Shabazz said that, too.
Well, I guess I do read that differently, and I think if we look back at the way the motion in limine was put in, that's certainly the way the trial was conducted. Look at this January 1997 letter. That's the way we defended it. And even if there was Dr. Albrechtsen was allowed to go into other matters, he didn't. He didn't put those things into the record. He didn't put those things before the jury. He certainly could have asked to, and to the extent he did ask to and wasn't allowed to, he could have brought evidentiary error or raised issues in that regard, but he didn't. We simply have a trial where this was the letter we were all looking at, where we have the materially adverse actions and no connective thing.
But what Judge Shabazz says, I just want to direct
okay.
you to appendix page 17.
What page do you have?
Appendix page 17 of the blue brief.
Thank you.
He says, this is in his ruling on the Rule 50 motion, I believe, that you claimed, as you are now, that there was an error in allowing the plaintiff to attribute retaliation to the January 10, 1997 letter. He says this letter was properly admitted to show knowledge that plaintiff had opposed gender discrimination.
And that's exactly the case.
And
that's
what he says he's doing with the letter. And he says somebody could interpret this letter as opposing gender discrimination.
He's looking back at his prior ruling and summarizing it. And I think properly and correctly summarizing it, basically, this was it. This was the letter that we were all focusing on, and this is what we were dealing with. Was this letter properly admitted, in his view, to show defendant's
knowledge
of that plaintiff had opposed gender discrimination? In order to prove retaliation, you've got to have two things. You've got to have protected conduct, at least two things, protected conduct, and you have to have knowledge of the conduct. And here, there was...
He's not saying, though, that this is the only protected conduct. He's saying that it was knowledge. You are saying it is the only protection.
Then let's go a little...
You may be right, you know, but that's not what Judge Shabazz said.
Let's go a little broader with that, then. Let's assume that it was open-ended and he could have put on anything at all. The testimony from Barnett, Greenhill, and Clayton was they had no knowledge of any prior complaints of sex discrimination by this individual before the events in question. So that would cover the scope. Albrechtsen had the perfect opportunity to come in and challenge that, show them any number of letters, had there been any evidence that would have helped him in that regard, cross-examine them, do whatever he wanted. He didn't do any of that. So it's left with lack of knowledge. That's one of the problems. The other big problem is there were very good reasons presented for the actions taken as to each of these on the suspension of the workshops. We had...
Well, you better reserve the rest of your...
I'll do that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Moriarty. Mr. Lasker?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am David Lasker, representing the appellee and cross-appellant, Dr. Albrechtsen. I would like to address some of the specific questions that were raised a moment ago with regard to the evidence. The evidence included a lot of testimony about... Dr. Albrechtsen's entire history on campus, going back to his complaints in 1989 that he was discriminated against as a male. And those The testimony with regard to that indicated in particular that he was complaining about the way he was treated at the time by the department, which included Dr. Clayton.
So could you maybe respond to the key points that your opponent has made just by giving a very brief summary of what evidence was before the jury on these various elements of the retaliation
yes,
claim?
Yes, I can. And there was evidence in front of the jury that for years, going back to 1989, he had fought the fact that he was being treated unfairly. That at the beginning of his complaints, it was clearly because he, as a male, was not being...
But now those letters were... There was no... The only written complaint was this January 10th, 1997 letter. Is that correct?
That is correct, I believe, because... and as Judge Shabazz noted during the trial, by January 10th...
That letter seems to me to contain nothing suggestive of gender discrimination.
The only part of it that does suggest gender discrimination is quoted by Judge Shabazz in
The word discrimination appears, but there's nothing. I mean, there are loads of grounds on which you can discriminate against. You can discriminate against a person because you think he's a pain in the neck, which is obviously what these people think about Albertson. But his recital is only about sex because he's complained about how Dr. Barak, who's a woman, is treated, and he complains about men who were mistreating him, as well as women. So I don't see anything in that letter. So somehow, maybe there's some other testimony, but everyone seems to say, or Judge Shabazz certainly suggested in what he said, that this letter was the key. This was the complaint which triggered this retaliatory business, and I just don't see it.
Your Honor, I don't believe that Judge Shabazz or anybody other than the defendants themselves have ever said that this January letter was the key.
I just have to look at Judge Shabazz's page.
But if not that letter, then what?
Years of complaining, including, and the reason that sex discrimination wasn't talked about more explicitly in the January letter was because he had been complaining about being retaliated against.
How are these years
constantly.
Of complaining demonstrated in the trial record?
They were demonstrated in the trial record in two ways. There were hundreds of exhibits, including each of the letters that Judge Wood was referring to earlier. Which did not become admitted into evidence because
they
the testimony in regard
trial. I'm not interested. I'm interested in what was in evidence at trial.
The testimony
that you are most relying on.
I'm most relying upon the testimony of Dr. Albertson. Certainly.
Where do you want me to look? What's your key statement?
He testified for hours on the stand about.
Tell me what you think is the best evidence.
Best evidence.
My colleague said she was frustrated with your adversary's brief. I was frustrated with your brief because your brief, when it comes time to say what's the key evidence, says, go look at our complaint. You know what the value of a complaint is after you've had a trial on the merits?
Your Honor.
Zippo.
Your Honor, the brief refers to specific pages of the transcript.
It is remarkable that your brief contains no statement of fact.
The statement of facts, it contains references to facts in the record by trial transcript references,
That's
Your
not,
Honor,
you know, you're
for pages.
You put a statement of facts in your brief, especially when your whole disagreement with your opponent is over the facts.
Well, I think that
there is an alternative to putting a statement of facts in your brief. It's to adopt the statement of facts of your opponent.
I was just going to say that his statement of facts contains a lot of the facts upon which we relied. But the fact is that
all right, but let's come back to my question. You want to tell me the very best place to go in the record. Where is that?
The very best places in the record are the direct testimony of Dr. Albertson.
This is non-responsive, counsel.
If you want to
ask you the best places and you just say, go read the whole record, it won't work.
If I may.
I will be happy to go to where you think is the best place.
Uh, I'm referring to testimony that is cited in my brief, both with regard to Dr. Albrechtson's testimony and the cross-examination of the individuals, at pages 7 of my brief, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, those pages in particular, Your Honor, which include
your brief is not the record.
Well, the brief
maybe you're hoping the maybe you're hoping that I will go and do an independent search, but when a judge asks you where is your best evidence in the record, you should be able to cite some part of the record.
This cites to volume 1, page 136, volume 1, pages 121 to 187, volume 1, page 227, and so forth, Your Honor. I hope that I have done an adequate job of pointing to
this. So in these pages, which I haven't looked at, did he state, did Albrechtson say that he had complained to these defendants, or some of them, or that they were discriminating against him because he was a man?
Yes, as well as complaining to them about all of their retaliatory actions specifically. And it is true that everybody came to know so well that he was complaining about it being unfairly treated as a man that for most of the time all he talked about was the specific act of retaliation that he was now complaining about.
Now, you say almost nothing in your brief about damages. What are we supposed to do about that? You have about like a page on damages. They make very specific points. You don't respond.
Well, the evidence in support of Judge Shabazz's decision on the remediator is substantial, and I didn't see what more I could add to it.
This kind of a Santa Claus business, you get up in front of the jury and you say, oh, I have stress. And they give you $250,000, and the judge says, oh, that's too much, just $100,000. But what's the control over this? Anybody can get up and say, oh, they harassed me, these harridans, they made my life miserable. And so I have stress. I don't have any, you know, medical bills or psychiatric consultations or anything. I just feel stress.
Yes,
so what? How does the legal system control this? Juries giving other people's money on the basis of some sob story that has no substantiation.
Well, I do think the jury process itself is the answer, Your Honor. Dr. Albrechtson testified
extremely. There's no control. Let me ask you another. I don't get your cross appeal either. Are you seeking additional damages? Is that why you filed a cross appeal?
I'm seeking the opportunity to, yes.
You want another trial on damages. You want another trial at which, how would you show additional damages?
Judge Shabazz ruled that the $250,000 that the jury awarded should be scaled back to $100,000 because he felt the jury was essentially awarding damages for what would have been attributable to the individual defendants over a period of 6 years instead of the specific two acts that were the subject of the Title VII action.
I don't understand. How could the... Well, let me drop that.
What about back pay? What possible reason was there for Judge Shabazz to use $500 as the appropriate baseline for that calculation when the absolute maximum difference between what he got and the top pay was $86?
Because the sum of $500 could be extrapolated from the history of the effect of merit pay on a person's pay over time. What happens is that you get a merit pay increase, which then has an effect on the kind of increase that you'll get in the future. And it was that formula that I believe he was taking into consideration in finding that figure to be reasonable.
What evidence was there that it was going to be around $500? I mean, the only evidence that I am aware of, although I certainly haven't sat down and read the whole transcript either, is this $86 difference and how that leverages itself up into $500, I just didn't see where the evidence supported that.
I believe that the $86 figure was being argued by Dr. Clayton and the defendant. The testimony of Dr. Albertson, again, on the subject of the effect that it had on his actual pay, and my cross-examination of Dr. Clayton, where she conceded some of the points that he had made in his direct testimony, would have been the basis for that in the evidence.
Why did he refuse, or did he refuse to furnish his updated resume?
He did because they already had it and because he knew that it was just a pretext for giving him more grief. And he just, at that point, refused to play the game any longer. Your Honor, the jury really understood that so well.
When you say he already had it, do you mean to say they had in their possession a resume that had exactly the same informational content as anything he could have given them? I mean, I don't know quite what you mean by that.
I mean that.
And did he tell them that? Did he say, you already have the most updated resume I could give you?
I don't think he did, because, as I say, he wasn't going to countenance their BS.
How do we know that it's the same information?
They acknowledged on cross-examination that they did have a resume from him, and his testimony confirmed the fact that the resume they had was a current resume.
What is the basis for the lost outside income damages?
Dr.
I understand the claim, it's that somehow your client lost outside income because he couldn't teach these classes. But usually, academics who have outside businesses view classes as an interference with them. Less teaching means more outside income. How is it here that less teaching means less outside income?
He testified at great length about the income that he had attained from outside activities, writing and lecturing, prior to the crescendo of the retaliation that he was being put up, that he was being subjected to in the summer of 98.
And when did that fall off? Your adversary says in its brief that it fell off in 1997, a year before the events in question.
The events in question were simply the crescendo of increased retaliation that began back in January of 97. Indeed, it's being talked about in the January 10, 1997 letter. And Dr. Albertson demonstrated that all of the income that he had had prior to January of 97 he no longer had ever after
where,
the middle
where
of 97.
Where can I find this argument in your brief? Your adversary said that these whole loss of outside income damages were not based on the record. And I looked in your brief for a response to it and didn't find any response at all.
Your Honor, respectfully, I did respond on this point, and I did make the point on page 13, I believe it is. The effect upon Dr. Albertson began to occur in the fall, summer or fall of 1997, and that was the testimony in the record, and so it was reasonable for the jury to conclude that
that was
the case.
You give no record references, as you'd have been required to do if you'd done a statement of fact.
There's just nothing in here that would...
31 to 44 and page 53 of volume 3 of the transcript?
Yes, those are the references in the record at the top of the page of page 13. It is just those three pages. Those three pages, yes.
Well, the segment, you mean...
14 pages.
Yes, 14 pages, if it's from page 31 to 44.
Oh, yes, I beg your pardon.
Go back to this resume business. Okay, so you say, so what? You got in discovery or something, you got the resume that was in the defendant's file?
No, there was only testimony about it.
What was the testimony?
The testimony of Dr. Clayton conceded that she did have a resume in file because she was chair of the department. And Dr. Albertson...
And what was the date of the resume?
I don't recall what the date of the resume was, or even if it had a date. But Dr. Albertson...
It had no date. And it wasn't in the record. How did Albertson know it was a current resume?
Because he had supplied it. And
when?
Not long before he was asked again to supply one. And he did so regularly as a member of the department, as did other members of the department. I mean, it was just a very spurious point they were making.
Okay, so you're saying there's evidence that he had recently supplied. If we look in the record, we'll find evidence that he recently supplied a resume.
You will in his testimony, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Lester.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Moriarty, how much time? One minute?
Thank you, Your Honors. I did check the statement of facts, my statement of facts, and found I had omitted the reference to the prior courses and apologized. The evidence is clear. It contains a gap between the essential parts of a retaliation.
What about this resume business?
The resume was asked for. At the advice of legal counsel, a resume was asked for, an updated resume, so that we could assess whether or not Dr. Albrechtsen should be able to teach these courses, whether he had the essential qualifications. And as Dean Barnett pointed out in his testimony, his clear testimony, that a resume can serve many different purposes. Whatever Dr. Albrechtsen may have put in the department file, and it is unclear when it was put in the file and how old it was, whatever he may have put in the file certainly wouldn't have been crafted for the purpose here. So that's why you ask the person, the subject, to provide the resume. That's what all the cases talk about. You know, give us a resume. It's not up to somebody else to give us a resume. In fact, if the reverse had occurred, and this assessment had been done based on a resume that the department pulled out of the file, and Albrechtsen had never been given an opportunity to update his resume, there's cases which we cite in the brief that talk about not paying attention to updated resumes.
But you never made an assessment based on the information that you had.
No, we were waiting.
It all just got frozen.
The default
position would be to say to Dr. Albrechtsen, okay, you haven't given us a new one. We're going to look at the old one and see if your degrees and whatever are reflected there.
But that never happened. My time is up.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Moore. Thank you to both counsel.